Oh, hey, just a real live talking buck here. Did you know that you can save a lot of bucks during the big old Tire Save a Buck sales event? Yeah, you can.
Now save up to $250 on select sets of tires with paid installation at your local Big O. That's a lot of bucks you'll save. Plus, get our low price guarantee. Save on a synthetic blend oil change too, including tire rotation. Now just $34.99 and get zero interest financing for up to 12 months on qualifying purchases.
Save a buck sales event. Woohoo! Now at Big O Tires, the team you trust.
With markets changing and living costs rising, finding a reliable place to grow your money matters now more than ever. With the Wealthfront Cash Account, your uninvested money earns a 3.75% APY, which is higher than the average savings rate. There are no account fees or minimums, and you also get free instant withdrawals to eligible accounts 24/7, so you always have access to your money when you need it. And when you're ready to invest, you can transfer your cash to one of Wealthfront's expert-built portfolios in just minutes. More than 1 million people already use Wealthfront to save and build long-term wealth with confidence. Get started today at Wealthfront.com. Cash account offered by Wealthfront Brokerage, LLC, member FINRA SIPC. Wealthfront Brokerage is not a bank. Annual percentage yield on deposits as of September 26, 2025 is representative, subject to change, and requires no minimum. The cash account is not a bank account. Funds are swept to program banks where they earn the variable APY.
You, the cost of building a green roof, as long as you commit to maintaining it for a minimum of 20 years. So that program has been in place for 20 years, and it hasn't been very well used, but because it's the city and all the other hurdles and paperwork you have to go through, and you know, a lot of small landlords.
When I first started in construction, a roof was a roof. We just had shingles, some plywood, flat roof, A-line roofs, roll-out roofs. But a lot has changed in the industry because of technology, the advancement of technology, because of the implementation of solar, because of the implementation of things that has taken the industry by storm. And some of these things has impacted the consumer. Some consumers are being overcharged. And some are finding cost savings. And you're a normal or a commercial real estate owner, and you're pressed with trying to figure out what directions you should go in terms of all of the information that's out there, because we are being hit with a bunch of information. Everyone has the best solution. Nobody's going to go there and say, hey, we got a BS product. Everybody has the best solution. Everybody has the highest quality. Everybody has the new model. So this episode is for you. By the end of this episode, you'll understand how to approach the technology and the industry that has been ever-changing. My name is Noron Tillman. This is Walk in Victory, where we sit you at the feet of the masters and evolve your life through conversations. Our conversation today brings us to the topic of roofing. Joshua, how are you, sir? Josh, I should say.
I'm very well. Either one's good. I'm very, very well, thank you, Noron. And, you know, I'm kind of privileged to be here in a certain sense, because I'm not a builder, I'm not a roofer, I'm not an engineer. What I am is someone who looks at how can we live our lives better? How can we live our lives more holistically? And part of that is living better in balance with the world around us. And since shelter and housing is a key part of how we all live, it involves looking at that in different ways. And actually involved with a couple of different companies, and one of them would be very charmed by your statement of new technology, because they're a wood innovations company that's been trying to get a kind of wood building material called mass timber into the market in the west coast of California. And their constant complaint is that builders are still working in a system that's basically unchanged since 1920s, and that it's balloon and stick housing that just sort of goes together and that nobody wants to change. So I think everybody comes to this with a range of opinions and experience, and but we all need housing. And one thing I do observe is that housing varies depending on where you live, what the tools are available, what materials are available, and what kind of climate you live in. And when we try to make it all the same and we try to sort of create mass-produced, standardized things, we often do that at the expense of a better, more effective, and sometimes even more affordable living situation for people. So just as a general rule, and I'll just make one observation from traveling in South America, that when I was living in Ecuador and living in Peru for various periods of time, in Peru, which is, they're both countries with a lot of poverty and a lot of wealth inequality, but in Peru, a lot of people can build their own houses out of the local dirt and soil and adobe and mud. So people had a different kind of shelter experience, because you had the tools and material that was available with your own skills, your own ability, your own craftsmanship, your own cultural histories of how to do that. And we often lose that when we come to this country. We often lose that notion that we have an ability to say what we live in and how we live. Okay, so anyway, that was just where your intro took me, is that we're there. I totally recognize if you go into Home Depot and you try to like say, I want a house, Home Depot, where are you? Help me. That's kind of a bewildering and difficult place to be for a lot of people.
At Arizona State University, we're bringing world-class education from our globally acclaimed faculty to you. Ranked number one in innovation for 11 consecutive years and number two among public universities for employability, ASU isn't just ahead of the curve. It's creating new paths to success. Earn your degree from the nation's most innovative university. Online, that's a degree better. Explore more than 350 undergraduate, graduate, and certificate programs at asuonline.asu.edu.
Hiring isn't just about finding someone willing to take the job. You need the right person with the right background who can move your business forward. If you want candidates who truly match what you're looking for, trust Indeed Sponsored Jobs. With Indeed Sponsored Jobs, your post stands out to quality candidates who actually fit the role. According to Indeed data, 90% are more likely to be hired and trusted by 1.6 million companies. Spend more time interviewing candidates who check all your boxes. Less stress, less time, more results. Now with Indeed Sponsored Jobs. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to help your job get the premium status it deserves at Indeed.com/podcast13. Just go to Indeed.com/podcast13 right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/podcast13. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Do it the right way with Indeed.
First, yeah, so here I go now. I was muted. First of all, if you go to Home Depot, you, one, pack your lunch and bring somebody who desires to work there, because you can't never find any help.
Right.
So you, and I like the fact that you started with the fact that you have no hat in the race, so to say. You're not a roofer. You're not. But you're looking at the industry on how to make better choices for the consumer. So you have the consumer in mind first, and you've been able to look at housing as one of the pillars by which you can help bring consumer costs and use the resources that are available to us, which are natural resources that we have on a day in, day out basis. Can't manufacture sun.
Right. And that's I think, a really important piece of how we need to approach things. I mean, if you're in a city, I mean, you know, it's hard to build a single family home in a city, in general, a city like New York City, and, you know, particularly that's already been built in. But that doesn't mean that housing inevitably has to be as expensive as it is, and it doesn't mean that living costs inevitably have to be as expensive as they are. It's not exactly a construction concept, but, you know, New York City is a pretty interesting example. When the city went bankrupt in the 70s, the New York City still had a pretty big industrial base. It still had a pretty big garment center. It still had a major printing industry. There were hundreds of thousands of working class jobs and hundreds of thousands of union jobs. And the city fathers, in their infinite wisdom, recognizing that the city was in a state of bankruptcy, made the decision that all of those industries were dead industries. Hmm. And that the living industries were going to be banking, financial insurance, and, you know, and real estate. Finance, insurance, and real estate. RE. Real estate. And notice real estate gets two letters of that four-letter word. Okay, so when real estate becomes a financial instrument and a profit center, then it's about making money, not creating shelter. It's not about housing people. It's about housing money and dollars. And you see that. In the 1930s, Fiorello LaGuardia, the very visionary mayor of New York, built tens, hundreds of thousands of units of city-built public housing, some of which still remains and some of which still allows people to live, you know, very reasonably on the kinds of salaries a normal person gets with a wage. And some of them, and they were all, and this is the part, this is what struck me from your original intro, is they're all different kinds of solutions. He threw mud at the wall. He said some of them are what they call mutual houses, where, you know, everybody owns a piece of the, and, you know, you pay the pay a percentage of your income maxed out. You know, of course, there's a 25-year waiting list for those, but there's probably 10,000 apartments in New York that are built that way. Others of them are controlled under different kinds of regulatory housing. But all of them had a notion that the community had a stake in affordable housing, and that the city, as a representative of the community, as a democratically organized body that was able to make collective decisions on behalf of everyone, chose to make those collective decisions on the behalf of a pretty large section of everyone. No one ever gets covered, everyone. That would be a perfect world, and sadly, you know, we're never going to live in a perfect world. But they made a big effort to do that. Whereas the fire discussion, or the fire sale of New York, as I like to call it, they didn't look at the interests of everyone, at the interests of the people at the top who had all the money, and how are they going to continue to make money, and they thought they would trickle down the impact of that. And that's what we see in a lot of places. We see, you know, various kinds of collective housing trickling down. And currently now, a lot of people are renting, find that same problem, that their houses no longer belong to a single landlord. Their houses belong to some giant. Their landlord is no longer, you know, somebody down the block they can talk to. If something goes wrong, they're now some nameless corporation, increasingly a hedge fund, which is 2 degrees of separation away from being separated from you. So those are big picture issues, you know, and that's, I don't know if that's really where your focus is, but those are the sort of some of what I like to think of as the structural issues around housing. We no longer treat it as shelter. Well, we no longer make it accessible to us. And so those start from there, and then you can move into lots of different conversations about how you work in that universe.
Well, if we look at from that lens of the big picture issue as it relates to housing, that train has left the building, so it's really not going to come back. In terms of how housing is being impacted, and I'm going to use New York City as it's, and the way commercial real estate is being impacted now, we see a lot of empty units in the commercial side, so there's less demand for that. We're having a square footage blueprint or footprint in Manhattan was worth thousands of dollars per square foot, $20,000 per square foot. The market is saying that it's not worth that anymore. On the flip side, we have a homeless issue, and the market is saying we can't afford to house them. Yet we have all of these empty units. So the humanitarian side of it is gone, because rents don't go up to come back down.
Not anymore. That's not always been true.
Okay. So not anymore.
Because not anymore.
Greed is leading the day right now. Mm-hmm. And we can probably agree with that. Greed is leading the day. And now we have to find a way. And I think that this, I see this happening because we do see a lot of new thought leaders who have compassion and they're leading not with their wallet. They're not trying to be an elite, a one percenter. Although they have the capacity to do what they want to do, they still have compassion on a different level, on a deeper level. And I see that happening in across all industries. How can that, and the work that you're doing so that people can understand the marriage of that, the empty units that we see that's happening all over the place, not just New York, but it's happening all over, the fact that there's going to have to be a solution, that we have this real homeless issue, we have all of these issues really emerging at the same time, and we have persons like yourself who has done the work, who sees the lens and can bring real solutions to the table.
Even though we're talking about New York, let me bring in a West Coast process that, that may shed light on that. Sorry to shift.
No problem.
Coast here. Okay. I mentioned one of the companies that I work with. They are trying to do exactly what you're doing. Mm. They are a wood remanufacturing company. So California, for example, has set many big issues. Okay. It has a huge homeless population, probably the most significant in the country, just in terms of percentage and number, partly due to the weather, partly due to policies, partly due to all sorts of economic struggles. They have a 2 to 3 million housing deficit already. Mm. They're, they got 40 million people and they're 2 million housing units short of where they need to be.
Wow.
They also have a giant fire crisis, which is in the news a lot.
Yes.
And that fire crisis is a complicated story, but it's basically because the policies of how they've dealt with their forest land have been to not let fires burn for almost 250, since the Spanish came into San Diego in 1707. And the first thing they did was they rounded up all the natives and they put them into what you can charitably call concentration camps. They didn't call them that, of course. And as soon as some of the people started to go out of these camps to the countryside to do what they had done for millennia, which was set small fires to help the landscape rejuvenate, they were suppressed. So since 1707, now in other parts of the West, it's been more recent, but since California, it started 150 years before the gold rush. So that means the wood just grows and it overgrows, and that's what's burning. There's almost an order of magnitude more trees on the forest lands in California and almost that much in other parts of the Western states than the land can support. And the way that the natural balance works is it catches fire, it burns down, and then it regularizes itself. It's when it was doing that through the forests and native people arrived in quantities after the last ice age. There were people before the ice age, but as the ice receded, the forest grew, and as the forest grew, the number of people that land could support grew. So the native population grew with the forests, and they understood that these forests needed fire to survive. They're fire-adaptive landscapes. It's wet in the wintertime with rain, and it dries all summer and gets hot in the summer, so all that nice green turns to brown and turns to kindling, essentially, every summer. And if you don't clear it out on a regular basis, it grows and gets accumulates like a garden gets too crowded, and then it burns. That's the normal process. So you need to get that wood off the landscape. You get that what they call biomass off the landscape. And most of that isn't the big trees that people think of when they think of lumber. A lot of it is what they call small diameter wood, sometimes 4, 6, 8 inches in diameter. And that lumber mills and typical sawmills can't handle that too much. So you have this huge supply issue. You've got all this stuff. And then let's add one more piece of complication. The majority of wood in the Sierra Nevada are two, I mean, there's a lot of different species, but two of the climax species.
Oh.
Forget something for your project? We've got you. At HomeDepot.com, get fast, free delivery on millions of items for whatever you're working on. same day or next day. We bring what you need, and you bring it to life. Get fast, free delivery only at The Home Depot. How doers get more done. Order select in-stock items by 4 p.m., subject to availability.
That are most prominent are Jeffrey and Ponderosa Pine. Wonderful trees, beautiful, they're lovely, they smell good. Builders don't like them very much because they grow in a little bit warmer climate than the Douglas fir, and so their tree rings are just a little bit further apart, and that translates into they're just a little bit less strong. And as you cut down a 2x4 from a nominal dimension of 2 inches by 4 inches to whatever it is now, 2 5/8 1 5/8 by 3 5/8 or something like that, that strength starts to make builders nervous. In balloon and stick housing in particular. So they're very suspicious of using material out of Douglas fir and Jeffrey pine, even though, gosh, if you walk around and look at any house that's not made of redwood and is over 100 years old in California, what do you think they made it out of?
Douglas pine.
What do you think? I'm going to give you two guesses.
The pine, the Douglas pine that you speak of.
Right, exactly. So here you have all these things that want to talk to each other. You've got a potential ply. There's not really that much timbering going on in California right now because of, again, another complicated set of stories, but the timber industry has declined, the mill population has declined. So you have this whole workforce development process. You've got this whole series of jobs available in fire management and forest management and wood products management. You can create this basically super plywoods out of these smaller diameter trees that are not only strong, they're literally stronger than steel. They're not only, and because they're plywood, you don't have air pockets. So guess what? That means they don't burn like very well. They char, but they don't burn, which means they hold their strength in fire even better than concrete. Concrete gets weak, you know, and that's why this particular material was originally developed by engineers who wanted a concrete replacement product they could build out of wood. So then you have this material. You need to create this industry, and then what do you do with it? You need to create not just single-family homes because the price, one, the economics don't work too well for mass timber at that point yet, but you want to create 3 to 5-story community housing of various kinds so that, and you want to put that in areas that are reasonably dense, what they call transit-oriented housing, and connected to arteries that don't require private cars, that are dense enough so that you can walk to your store, you can build supermarket stores and communities like we used to have. And let's go back to New York. Let's like Brooklyn, the Brooklyn communities, Bed-Stuy and Brownsville, what were they built? They were built with 3 and 4-story houses, and on the avenues they had stores on the top, and the storekeeper lived in that house, and everybody could walk. You could walk to 80% of what you needed, and if you couldn't find what you needed, you could walk to the train and take the train into the center of the city, into Manhattan, and get whatever it is you couldn't get from walking around in your community. That's the kind of model housing we need to re-look for, where people live together, they have community, they all have a joint. Now let's talk about greening now, because right now we're pacing, you know, one of the other things we do in cities is we forget that plants are a part of daily life, but we do that at a big cost, because what is the single, you know, we talk a lot about climate change and we talk a lot about global warming, and just to put this in perspective, this is the coolest summer of the rest of your life.
Wow.
And last year was the coolest summer before that. That is to say, those are the hottest summers on record.
Wow.
And they're going to just get hotter. What's the leading cause of death currently of adults in the United States? It's heat-related. And what does heat and of kids? Asthma is a terrible problem in urban death. So what do plants do? Plants are the tool that nature has used for over 250 to 400 million years to cool the planet. Well, how do they do that? Through the transpiration of photosynthesis. They take carbon dioxide, they suck it up, they convert it to oxygen and water vapors. And, you know, and that vapor, that transpiration, is the same thing that your air conditioner uses. When gases expand, they cool. And the power of that, just to give you a sense of it, 1 cubic centimeter of water, going from water to steam, releases about 550 calories. Okay, that means, and water is abundant material on the planet, and there's a lot of it going around. So that's more than CO2. You hear people talk about CO2 and the greenhouse effect. The real control of how warm and cool the planet is how it's through water vapor and the transformation of water, mostly through plants on land and through the ocean, evaporating off the ocean and, you know, on the ocean. That's a power that we're not using. By not having plants in our cities, we're pretending that doesn't exist. So let me just illustrate one thing again. If you're sitting in the Amazon and you're sitting on the ground in the Amazon in the middle of the jungle, and let's call yourself you're on the equator, do you have any idea what the temperature might be? It's a hot summer day in July. What the average temperature?
I know it's well over 100. Well over 100.
I mean, it's not cold. It's 85 to 90 degrees.
So why do we have this perception that it's so hot?
I'm gonna, you know, because we don't think, well, it's not cool. Let's not pretend it's cool.
Yeah,
that's not, you're not, you know, but it's not insane. Why is that? Because you're, two things. You're under a canopy of shade, which means the direct sun isn't hitting you. And you have all of this green material that's constantly.
You're muted. Give us a second, everybody. Your microphone is muted. There you go.
Okay, there it goes. Yeah, it's a self-muting. Maybe it got tired of me talking. I don't know.
No.
Okay, but why did you? I think I'm not sure where I got cut off. But you asked why is it cool in the cooler in the Amazon than your mountain? Let me just give you an example of the difference I'm talking about right now. Is if you just walked right across the Atlantic Ocean and you ended up in Africa. And you'll be in a jungle too, and it'll be the same temperature. But you go north to the Sahel or to the desert where there's no plant cover. Do you know what that ground temperature would be on that same July day where it's 85 to 90 in the canopy of the Amazon?
No.
It'd be about 110 to 140 degrees, depending on where you are. That's the power of plants. Hmm. That difference is what plants can do and what they do all over the world when we let them. So, it does that, again, through a combination of things. The biggest one is the evaporation of water as they convert carbon dioxide into oxygen. The second one is they reflect sunlight off away so it doesn't hit the ground and get hot. And the third one is they provide shade. So there's sort of a three-part punch. So all of those combine into it. So you take a green roof, you put that, and you, okay, so let me just go back to what else do they do before we even go there? The other thing that plants do in cities that are really important is small particles stick to plants. They adhere. In particular, what adheres to plants are the sub 2.5 micron particles, the really tiny ones that your nose can't filter, that your lungs can't filter, that are the most toxic. They stick to plants. When then it rains, that they drop, they go into the soil and become rendered inert. So they cool, they reduce the urban heat effect, they help substantially with pollution. And then what else do plants? They do many other things too, but the other thing that plants do, and we're not even talking about the benefits to a building owner yet, which we'll get to, but for the community, the other things that they do is they provide people with something that's not steel, rock, concrete, brick, in an inert substance to interact with, whether that's visually, whether that's socially, whether that's functionally, and if you're basically building a garden, if your interpretation of plants is you want a garden, then you're giving people utility, you're giving people connection to what they're doing. We're very, in the United States, many of us, particularly those of us in urban and suburban areas, and that's most of us, we're very disconnected from nature and natural processes. And food is in plastic, it comes packed. packaged. It's this stuff. It's not stuff you grow. You know, people are fortunate when they grow things. They used, we of course used to grow things directly a lot during World War II. In fact, the last time we had this kind of a crisis that mobilized, and we mobilized for it, 25 or 30% of the vegetables that people ate were grown in people's own backyards or front yards or roofs or fire escapes or whatever, or terraces or whatever they had, where there was a place they could put something down and grow vegetables. They did it. We did that then. We could do it again.
Yes. I have a vegetable garden in my backyard. And that's the spirit that we see happening in Brooklyn. We see a lot of greenhouses.
Absolutely. It's starting to come back really well. There's urban farms are starting to come back. And New York is a vertical building, which means you have a lot of rooftop, you know, a lot of streets are paved over and a lot of rooftops are there. And you also have a lot of sidewalls and you have a lot of other places. So if you think about something like New York City and its, you know, and it's thousands and thousands and thousands of multi-story buildings and small ones. And the roof. If you took the same amount of leafy green material that was present when Henry Hudson sailed up the Hudson River in 1606 and reached the island of Manhattan and looked at it, it was the richest oystuary anybody had ever seen. It was an incredibly fertile area. It was Manhattan, the land of many hills. It was many things. And you took the same coverage of complex plants and animals and you put them on the roofs, sidewalls, and streetscapes of Manhattan to the point of about 35 or 40% coverage. You don't have to do everything. You can reach the ambient temperatures that are the same as if those buildings weren't there.
Hmm.
And you don't have to replace the building stock to do that. You just have to basically think of it as a mountain. Think of it as Hawaii a million years ago when it came up from the sea and Hawaii today. But you're not spending a million years to get that kind of plant evolution. We humans are understanding the systems and we're adapting natural systems in a much more rapid way and we're cloaking what we can in different kinds of. Now that plant cover can be farmland, it can be any kind, it can be all kinds of things. And New York City has a decent head start because it's already 14 or 15% parks.
Yeah.
So it's not like it's nothing there. Yeah. But the parks are unevenly spread. And a lot of places that need the most help have the least parks.
Yeah.
So how do we fix that?
Yeah. So you're going on podcasts. You have all of this information. You're helping this industry as well as others to understand the possibilities that are there. But it also, for those who are listening, can help the consumer if they have an understanding, entrepreneurs, if they have an understanding that this stuff is available. Why is this mission so important to you? And can you just give our consumers one or two things that
sure.
are available, or our entrepreneurs that are available to them right now that they can start thinking about? Because we know knowledge is what? Power.
Yeah. Well, I think that's really important, and I really appreciate the opportunity to talk with you and your audience. Because it is power. And even more than power, knowledge makes sense when you put it to use. And the way you put it to use is to understand. We do this by story, you know, whether we call it stories or not. We do this by telling our stories. And one of the stories that you're saying is, yes, we can. We can do these things. These are things that are available to us. It's not over there. Somebody else can do it. It's not part of the, you know, something that's there. So I would say a couple of things. One of the challenges for green infrastructure in general is that we don't think about it. Another challenge is that because it's a new industry, a lot of times its upfront costs are higher, and we don't think about, we don't understand yet the economics because our whole economics or system is a little bit skewed. But I'd like to start with this idea of a difference between an appreciating asset and a depreciating asset. And anytime you build something out of concrete, anytime you build something out of steel, anytime you build something out of a hard material, it has a fixed life. Okay? It's gonna decay and you have to factor that in. Anytime you do something out of a living material and you maintain it, it's not magic. It grows, it gets stronger. So living materials are appreciating assets. They gain value as you care for them. A forest that starts as a bare rock, as you tend it, becomes a living forest as it gets stronger. Not only does the wildlife come in, not only does the biodiversity, its ability to hold water comes in, its ability to cool the mountains come in, its ability to provide all kinds of visual, scenic, and human benefits come in. It becomes richer and richer and richer with care over time. A building has a half-life. Now, some of these times, now the Romans knew how to build concrete like nobody's business, and they've got a building like the Pantheon that's 2,000 years old and going strong, and they're amazing. We don't do that.
No.
There's no modern American equivalent of the Pantheon. Yeah. Okay. So we need to think about things. We need to bring that into our thinking. We need to bring living materials into our thinking. And we can do that in lots of different ways. Now, the good news for New York City and a couple of other places, but New York City in particular, is that the people who run the city really also have a couple of big interests. They're concerned about the urban heat island effect. They're concerned about even, you know, which is important from their point of view because they're bean counters. They're also concerned about the fact that, you know, the city has a big stormwater collection problem.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
You know, that as, you know, we did a lot of really good work as a country in the late 1960s and the early 1970s. We passed the Clean Water Act. We were the leaders in the world, in the developed world, about how to manage water and sewer systems. So we managed to get a whole bunch of, most of the cities in America have stage three upgraded sewer systems, you know, which is terrific, including the towns along the Hudson Valley, which used to run directly into the Hudson River, and the Hudson River was incredibly foul, and now it's a much, much cleaned up river. Why, in part, in one big part of that is because we're no longer dumping sewage, except when it rains too hard. And why is that? Because in a 1970s infinite wisdom, we matched the capacity of sewage system treatment design to the number of toilets and sinks we expected.
I didn't ever know that. All right.
Right. Well, you know, they're engineers. Who did it? Engineers. And were the engineers thinking ecologically? No, they were thinking process-wise. And they had cost-benefit analyses going on. And they said, okay, so we'll build to the expected number of toilets, and we'll add a safety margin, which is great. Now, in New York City, that safety margin translates into 0.7 inches of rain per hour. So whenever it rains more than 0.7 inches in an hour, the system overflows. Okay, and that's something like that is true everywhere, that
yes,
we have the same kind of system. It's not true in Mumbai. Why? Because Mumbai, 400 years ago, decided to use basically a giant local wetland to be its sewage recovery system. And so they have one of the largest natural sewage systems in the world that's still working. And Mumbai is nobody's idea of a small town, a little country village. No, it's massively overgrown, has all kinds of other big urban issues, but it has one of the more environmentally sensible water treatment systems, you know, of any big city on the planet. We could have something similar to that in New York City. Not necessarily, you know, for one thing, that used to be what the Meadowlands did. That used to be what the Jersey Meadowlands were.
That's why it smells like that.
Well, it smells like it, but it doesn't have to smell like that. A lot of that is just, you know, basically, you know, the smell, the unavoidable smell of rotting vegetation. But it doesn't have to be as bad. All of those things are semi-designable. So they want to capture, you know, without getting too far afield here, they want to capture stormwater. And plants and soil capture stormwater. So that's one of the things. So the city actually has a subsidy. This is a long way of sort of saying the city has a really powerful subsidy, not so much for individual homeowners, but for people with buildings of 4,000 square feet and above, where they will essentially pay you the cost of building a green roof as long as you commit to maintaining it for a minimum of 20 years. So that program has been in place for 20 years, and it hasn't been very well used, but because it's the city and all the other hurdles and paperwork you have to go through, and, you know, a lot of small landlords are suspicious of anything that requires
anything that comes from the city.
But that doesn't mean it's not a good idea, and it's absolutely a very generous subsidy. It literally, they've just upped it to $40 a square foot for an intensive green roof, which is the cost of building it. So, I mean, that's basically a free roof as long as you take care of it for 20 years.
Wow, yeah.
You can't get a better deal than that.
No, it's a tax abatement.
Yeah. It's not even, no, they actually pay for it. It's not even a tax advantage. It's a subsidy. They actually will, once you put it in place and they approve it, they reimburse you for your costs.
Yeah.
And then you get other abatements, you know, because you get certain other kinds of tax credits as well. So it's not really a homeowner, but it's a small businessman's opportunity.
Well, you're doing a great job at really first explaining why this is important. Mm-hmm. Because we always hear the problem, but we very rarely hear the solution. So we have a bunch of people running around saying, oh, global warming, what are we going to do? What are we going to do? And you're saying, hey, the same guy who created the sun and created all that heat created some other stuff to help
you're
us.
Absolutely right. You're absolutely right.
Protect from the heat.
Well, actually, it's all from the sun. I mean, even, you know, fossil fuels, I mean, coal. What is coal? What is oil? It's 200 million-year-old living beings that are crushed under geologic pressure over time. Yeah. And where did that come? So it's fossilized solar energy. The difference is that we're burning 200 million years in 2 minutes.
Yeah.
That's
the problem. That's
the problem. Right. And, yeah. Right. I mean, that's what gives gasoline its oomph. But remember I said that a single cubic centimeter of water when it expands is 550 calories? That is 1/16th of the amount of energy in gasoline. So it's not trivial. There's way more water than there is gasoline. So that's a huge amount of energy that's encapsulated in water from water to steam that we aren't taking anywhere near advantage of.
But herein lies the rub, and I really thank you and appreciate your time. And when it gets down to the economics of it, are those who are at the helm willing to upskirt some of their profits for the good of humanity and to help lower the price point? I went to Manhattan a few weeks ago, and they were selling ramen noodles $30 a plate. I mean, come on.
were they letting you open the plastic cell for free? Is that part of the deal?
I don't know. Like, when I was coming up, we didn't even want to eat the stuff. Now people are paying $30 right. for it. You know, so this is the world that we live in.
Okay, so I'm going to push back a little bit.
Okay.
Because we live in what's nominally, again, present moment makes this a little hard to say, but we'll pretend. we'll pretend for a second. We live in what's nominally called a democracy, okay? And it starts with some language that says, we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal and endowed by the Creator with the power of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. And in order to secure these goals, I'm going to mangle this piece a little bit, governments are organized for the common good. That's up to us. We need to demand government because it's basically a common use issue. Why do we have government? We have government. I go back to Fiorello LaGuardia. There was a huge housing problem during the Depression. What did Fiorello LaGuardia do? He said, okay, we're going to use the tax revenue we have as a city, and we're going to spend it in these ways. Why? Because I think this is the best social use I have of our money, mm-hmm. of our collective money. So mm-hmm. we have more agency and power than we think of to steer that question a little bit, like it's not just noblesse oblige of let's the drops come down from the top. It's let's make that conversation a real conversation. That's one piece. Another piece of it is if you actually care about your children, and this is whether you're a billionaire or not, you have to acknowledge that short-sighted thinking is not going to help your children at all. Okay, and that whether you like it or not, whether you think it's politically convenient or not, whether you read the Wall Street Journal editorial pages or the news pages, because they're different. If you read the editorial pages and you think that global warming is a hoax and all these things are a problem, and you can pretend that's true. If you read the news pages, you know they're real. And there isn't anything you can do. As I said earlier, we are in the coldest summer any of us will ever feel for the rest of our lives. And next year will be the next coldest. And next year will be the next. Why? Because we have passed the tipping point where those things are stuff that's imaginary. We are now in the point where those are real. So anybody with wealth who's interested, and this is the person to have that conversation with, is where I'm going with.
Yeah.
The people to have these conversations with are that, unfortunately, small minority, but not non-minority, of people who do understand that these are things, and to work out the negotiated settlements. One of the things that we've done since 1980, since the election of Ronald Reagan, is we've impoverished our governments at all levels from the ability to do big things. Why is it that we could get somebody on the moon in less than 10 years? Because we thought it was an important thing to do. Why is it that we could transform the entire country from, it was an important thing? To do in the Depression? Why is it that in World War II we could mobilize the entire country and create a major recycling and reuse and repurposing economy? Okay, let me just say this. My great-grandfather had a pots and pans company in the South Bronx, on Bruckner Boulevard. On December 6th, 1941, he was making, 2,000 stainless steel pots a week, and he was distributing them all over the New York City area, and he was doing fine. He had a fine, good living. By February of 1942, he was making 10,000 machine gun links. Why? Same factory, same thing. And he was one of 1,000 companies, or 10,000, who even knows how many companies, that shifted on a dime. Because they could, because they knew it was necessary and they did it. So these are not things that can't happen. These are not things that we don't do. These are things that we have dumbed ourselves down against, but that doesn't mean we can't smarten ourselves up. We live in sometimes what I call the ahistorical present. We get confused that whatever's happening now has always been true and will always be true, neither of which is actually the case. It's just what's happening now. We have the ability at every level, from a tiny level, from a local, from a family, to a garden, to a commute, to a block, to a small town, to a community, to a nation, to say, I want to organize our lives somewhat differently. And if that means pooling a block's resources together to put in a park-like thing, to have a gardens in, to connect, to do, and if that means that maybe there's community food sharing, that they're cooking a collective meal, maybe there's some skill sharing that goes on informally, and that at a larger level it becomes more formal, those are all totally within our reach. They're totally free. They cost no money. They cost only will. And only insight, and only the will to do them, and the understanding that they're doable, and they have been done, and they will be done, and sometimes that's threatening. Let me be fair. What was the most threatening thing the Black Panther Party did in the late 1960s? They wanted to provide free meals for kids.
Yeah.
That was the most. That caused the Chicago Police Department to assassinate Fred Hampton.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, that's bottom line. Okay, so yes, it does disrupt the power structure. Sometimes the power structure acts very violent, but it doesn't have to.
No, it doesn't.
And it doesn't need to, and you don't need to be in that, you don't have to take it to that level of conflict to own your own agency. And that would be the thing that I would just stress. You can bring plants in, you can bring different building materials in, you can stop using disposable plastic. You want almost the single best, most accessible thing anyone can do anywhere, if you live in, is to stop buying throwaway plastic bottles for water. It's insanity. It's insanity. Spend $3, buy a, or whatever you want to spend, to buy a reusable container. New York City is blessed with, we've got Catskill Mountain Water. Catskills don't necessarily like it so much, but we've got it. It's clean, it's good, it's pure, it's better water than a lot of what gets put into some of the industrial plastic bottles. And it doesn't leach microparticulates. If you get an aluminum, or you get a copper, or you get even a hard plastic, you're not going to get nearly as much microplastic. You're not going to throw that stuff away. And that means it's not going to cost, all things like, it's not going to cost anywhere near as much money to, for waste and disposal. I mean, there are many, I mean, that's like another thing people can do very, very simply, is if they haven't replaced their incandescent light bulbs with LED light bulbs, gee, they're now down to $2 or $3 a light bulb. They last 10 years instead of whatever. You know, again, they even come in dimmable and other versions. You know, the amount of sort of small, low-hanging fruit, because we haven't thought about it.
Yeah,
we, you know, it's still, they're still accessible to us, because we didn't used to be that way.
No, we didn't.
No, you know, when I was a kid, Coca-Cola came in glass bottles, and you put them in metal racks, not wooden racks, not metal, that said Coca-Cola on it, and they got taken away. Milk came in a returnable bottle. You know,
yeah.
You know, people didn't use single-use materials very often. That was an advertising campaign, and I can tell you the name of it, because it was stuck in my 7-year-old kid's memory like nobody's business. No deposit, no return.
Well,
guess what? That's a bad idea. You want a deposit, you want a return.
You want a return. There you have it, everybody. Listen, this has been a very informative conversation. If you are a real estate owner in New York, or maybe looking in your city, and dollar for dollar, I just looked it up myself, these green roofs are available. It helps to keep down costs. It helps with infrastructure issues. You heard all that, the cost, not just the cost benefits. And I know that as entrepreneurs, I know that as homeowners and people who are in the real estate game, that we always look at the cost through the cost lens, but it's also helping the environment. And it's necessary, and it's something that we have to do. All of Josh's information is in our description. Get the Clarity call. He has all of the connections with the companies. If you're in the building industry and you want to start, if you even want to, as he said, talk about building your own agency and lead the cause to, or lead the pathway for others to hear about this type of information and do so in your community. Everything that you need to help our environment, everything that you need to help us walk in victory is here for you. We don't ask you for likes, subscriptions, or we do ask for likes. We do ask for subscriptions. We don't ask for Cash Apps or Venmos or any of those things, but we ask you for likes, subscriptions, and we ask that you leave a comment if you're listening on a platform where you can comment, so that other people can hear this information. This information is crucial, and it needs to get out. Most of all, it needs to be activated. We don't want to be hearers and not doers. We want to be doers and not just hearers only. Enjoy the rest of your day. Don't walk with your head down. Don't walk making excuses. Josh, you have the last word.
Well, thank you, Noron. That was a really inspirational close. I would just add one small economic thing that I didn't get to, which is that the four building owners of a certain size, it's for small commercial buildings in particular, you can save 35% on your heating and up to 35% on your cooling with a green roof. So there are real economic, tangible benefits that even if you don't have the New York City subsidy that basically makes it free, you're looking at a 5, 7, 10 year return, depending on all the different things you're doing. Plus you get a green roof, which you can do all kinds of cool things with, including growing your own food on. All right, so with that said, thank you all, and I welcome any interest that anyone has. Take care.
Peace, everybody. Hold your head up. Don't walk with your head down. Don't walk making excuses. Go get those green roofs. Let's not rely on people to feed us. We can feed ourselves. Enjoy the rest of your day. Peace. Thank you so much. That was